Lecture 35, Artificial Languages.
While Creoles are new languages that were created largely unconsciously, there have been many languages that have been created deliberately, particularly with the goal of creating a universal language to get us past the problems that having 6,000 different languages creates. These artificial languages, whether they have succeeded or passed away after a brief period of time, which has been the case with most of them, are part of the natural history of language. So as we get into the home stretch, we should take a visit to some of these artificial languages. These languages include sign languages used by deaf people, although they're not usually parsed that way. So part of this lecture will be to look at sign, which is very much a language just like the 6,000 that I've been talking about. Not that I've actually mentioned anything near all 6,000, but you take my point. So, artificial languages have been invented especially since the 1800s. There have been various attempts to knit the world together by creating one language that everyone will speak, the goal being not that the other languages won't survive, but that there will be one tongue that everybody can use as a lingua franca. The ground is littered with many different attempts of this sort. It's hard to get people to speak an artificial language. It's not in your heart. And of course, being human is all about the heart. So there are always these problems. The first artificial language that had any kind of sway was in the late 1800s, and it was called Volapük. And the name alone was not exactly advantageous, but it was created by a man who wasn't terribly concerned with such things. And it was in 1879 that he invented it. He was a priest, he was Bavarian, and he was kind of a taskmaster. His idea of the universal language was that it would be kind of a cross between Romance and Germanic, because he was a European, that's what he knew, and of course the universe is Europe and then some other people. And this is a different time than ours. One sympathizes with that benighted worldview. But 40% of the vocabulary was English. But Volapük did pretty well for a while. But it was never more than something that people who didn't have enough to do met in clubs about on Sunday. It never got beyond that. And that was because the person who invented it had an interesting sense. And I can wrap my head around the way somebody would think this. He actually thought that the difficulties that make regular languages so hard to learn are necessary rather than accidents, and that therefore if you create a universal language, you have to make it hard. And so it actually has this very complex series of endings that, you know, you have to memorize, and it's got these umlauted vowels. I have an idea, I suppose, that he had as a German, that was what a language was supposed to have, and so oo, e, o, e, and things like that. And so Volapük makes a certain impression, and it's not the most welcoming one. I mean, if you want to be synesthetic about it, Volapük seemed to be covered with spines. So, for example, the Lord's Prayer, O our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. In Volapük, this was, O fat obas kelbinol insuls, pai saludamis nem ola. Now, of course, it's just a conglomeration of sounds. What is beautiful to us is hideous to others, and so on. But even if we're just going to put ourselves in the mind of most Indo-European speakers, it's not terribly attractive to the extent that we value, all of us value Italian for having so many words that end in vowels and nice open singable sounds. You would dread Don Giovanni in Volapük, for example. So Volapük didn't hold on. I remember in my junior high school, for some reason, every now and then, there were ancient books, like books from the library at Alexandria, that were sometimes sitting on the shelves from earlier stages of the school. And I remember one time, my math teacher with his pink pants, who always smell kind of like gin, was kind of dragging on about something unnecessary. So I kind of reached up onto the shelf and I just pulled down one book. And that's how I found out what Volapuk was, because that was on the spine. And you can't help wondering what that is. This old gray book. And because I was clinically insane as a teenager, I liked to teach myself languages. And generally, if I found a book somewhere, you know, I would want to learn it. I'd go through that book. Volapuk was one of the only books I've picked up where I looked at the grammar and I thought, gosh, I don't want this. I'm not going to learn it. And I put it back up on the shelf and started listening again to Mr. Pink Pants. So that is Volapuk. Now, it was different when one rainy day in 1978, when I was in the library, I bent over to the bottom, kind of where other languages were, and I still remember this vermilion book with these strangely yellow pages, and when you smelled them, they smelled caramelized. The book smelled like a kind of a combination of a librarian's skirt and Christmas. And it was this little book, and it was about something called Esperanto. And I had never heard of Esperanto, but it sounded hopeful because of that root. So I found out that Esperanto was another artificial language. This one held on longer. Esperanto was invented in 1887 by Ludwig Zamenhof, and he was someone who had been troubled by the animosity between cultures speaking Russian, Yiddish, German, and Polish as he was growing up in Bialystok, where he had all of these languages at his command. So he invented Esperanto. Once again, like the Volapuk inventor, his idea was that the universal language somehow had to be Romance and Germanic. He came before our era when we are more aware of and more open to the true diversity of the world. It wouldn't have occurred to him that the universal language should be one that's presented with the soundtrack of African drum beats and with some tones from Chinese and taking a cue from the Aborigines in Australia. That's just not his world. So to him, universal is European languages. Within that, however, he created something that was much easier for a person to embrace. It was an admirable job. Esperanto has had some success. It's said that there are a million speakers. I'll just use that figure. That's what Esperantists say. Apparently there are around the world. So there are many, many, many speakers of Esperanto who did not begin with English. There are many who did not begin with a European language. And when you consider that there are Esperantists, as they call themselves, who communicate despite one being Chinese and the other one being an English speaker, that's pretty special. Chinese is very hard to learn. In one of these lectures, you listen to me pretending to use Cantonese. So if somebody who speaks Cantonese and somebody who speaks English actually have something to communicate in and they can do it, then that is a wonderful thing. There is a literature. Some classics, many classics, have been translated into Esperanto. Also, the Bible. I don't know how many of the Shakespeare's, but there is definitely an Esperanto Hamlet. Even the Quran. It's interesting, that bit about the virgins, the 72 virgins. There's increasing evidence that what the Quran meant by that was grapes. It was grapes that you were going to get in heaven. I wonder if the Esperanto version of the Quran mentions the grapes or whether it has the virgins. Anyway, Esperanto has done so well partly because of its very user-friendly structure. It has, so to speak, 16 rules. I remember the caramelized book, and it said 16 rules. And I thought, well, I can learn this in an afternoon. And the funny thing is that I did, to the extent that I learned those rules. You still don't know any words. But basically, nouns all end in O. Adjectives all end in A. Verbs all end in I. And so, if you have a root, varm, well then, varma is warm, varmo is warmth, and varmi is to warm. Isn't that nice? Like right there, it's a language that you want to hug and feed a little hot dog and put to bed. It's very important. Present tense is indicated with as. No, o, as, a, amos, eis, an, no, parlons, parlez, none of that. Any present tense verb, us. Nothing's irregular. Everything's smooth. Nothing bothers you. It's a wonderful language in that way. The past, is. The future, os. And conditional, us. And that's all you really have to know. There's an imperative, the command form, u. And so, it's very easy to create new words. It's very easy to understand the words that you encounter. And there are all sorts of suffixes and prefixes that you can use to create new words. So, koko is a rooster. Kokino, where you put in between the k and the o, is a, I almost said female rooster, is a hen. Or an arbo is a tree. And then a forest is an arbaro, with the ar meaning a collection of things. And so you have a little series of those. They're like little blocks that smell good. The whole language is just such a wonderful sensory experience, and it never bothers you. And Esperanto has this bias towards European languages, and sometimes in a way that should be changed. Like, for example, it has a marker of direct objects. You have to stick an N onto the end of things to indicate that something is a direct object. Now, that's not necessary. That is something that a person who grew up speaking languages like Russian and Polish and German might think is necessary. But we who speak English know that if I say the boy bounced the ball, we don't wonder, well, is it that the ball was bouncing the boy, or was the bouncing done to the ball, or was it done to Laura Bush, or something like that. We know that the ball is the object. So you don't need that. Or even having a conditional, the idea that you have to be able to say, I would go, is actually not true. Even Latin didn't have a series of endings to do that. The Romance languages developed that conditional just because they did. You don't have to have that. But still, those are minor quibbles. And so with Esperanto, if you are familiar with French, Spanish, Italian, or Portuguese, or even English, if I read the following passage, you might be able to get the gist. Here's a bit of Esperanto. Simpla flexebla practica solvo de la problemo de universala intercompreno, Esperanto meritas vian seriosan consideron. That is, a simple, flexible, practical solution to the problem of universal understanding, Esperanto deserves your serious consideration. So, simpla, flexebla, practica, solvo de la problemo de universala intercompreno, Esperanto meritas vian seriosan consideron. If you like languages, you want that in your mouth. I mean, it's a very nice language. It is also, and I'm going to get mail for this, but it's true, it is also never going to be the world's universal language. It's been around for a lot more than 100 years. And unfortunately, the world's universal language is this mundane, hideous thing that I'm speaking right now, and it's going to be forever. It will not be replaced by Chinese. This is it. We're stuck with it. And that means that there's no reason for there to be another one. Esperanto is a matter of a series of very diligent clubs. There are even some children who are being brought up in it with other languages. It's even changing over time the way a language does because it's being used in human mouths. But Esperanto seems to have hit a kind of a plateau. It's a beautiful language. It's a great idea. It's fun to learn. It's a great concept. But the universal language seems to be English. I am unaware of modern attempts to create a universal language in this way. Klingon doesn't count, and that's partly because English has taken over. So it used to be, for example, that you would open up a Berlitz self-teacher, you know, something, teach yourself German in 4 hours or something like that. And there would be all these scenes, these books mostly written around after World War II, of a man in a fedora and a woman in a skirt pretending to like him, and then these little kids, and they're in, you know, Germany, and they're at the hotel, and they have to use German. They have to actually ask for the hotel in German. Nowadays, the books have that scene much less, and because it's not necessary. If you put on a fedora and make your wife wear a skirt and take the kids and go to Germany, at the hotel, the woman or the man there speaks English. English is everywhere. People who don't speak English generally live somewhere where nobody who speaks English would ever go, and they are not playing a larger role in society. So we have a universal language, and it's not Esperanto, but if it was, it would certainly be dandy. Now, then there have been many other artificial languages, and to just tick them off would not serve any particular purpose. You can go to the books for that. Suffice it to say that a lot of them are a lot like Esperanto, and Esperanto seems to be the best of that gang. But no discussion of artificial languages would be complete without a quick look at Sol Re Sol, which was invented in France by a well-intentioned idiot in the early 1800s who had the idea that we could actually have a language based on the universal communication system of melody. And it's a lovely idea. And he thought that the advantage of Sol Re Sol would be that you could either sing it, or you could whistle it, or you could play it on an instrument, and that we would have this musical world. And so he came up with this whole language where related sequences of pitches were assigned to related words. And so, for example, I was and then you was and so do re is I and do mi is you. Or time just alone was do re do. So and then day was and then week was and then month was and then year was and then century was you get it. And so this was a real idea. And then there were these cute little opposites. And so I guess you could whistle one. Good was, and then bad was, that sort of thing. So the idea was that you're supposed to use these tones. Needless to say, Sol Re Sol was a miserable failure. But I don't think that anyone should go through life without knowing that such a thing once existed, like an aardvark or something. So that's artificial languages that one writes down. More successful, and in a way more useful than Esperanto, would be sign languages. When you see, there's a great episode of Michael J. Fox's sitcom Spin City, where for some reason the person who they have signing for the mayor's speech is not there, and they have to bring in a temp. And the temp who has gotten through doesn't know any sign language, and so he just starts doing all these random stupid symbols, like punching himself in the face to indicate robbery and things like that. And Michael J. Fox jumps him, and it ends up being a grand insult to the deaf people of the community. And that was an indication that signing is not just a matter of this kind of desperate mimicry that people have worked out by spending enough time with each other that they kind of know what each other meant. That throwing the hands around and the wiggling of the eyebrows, all of that is a language. A language in the sense that it's hard to learn, that you can do it badly, that you can do it sort of well, that you can be pretty darn good but still have a bit of an accent, so to speak, manually. Signing is real. And there are dozens of sign languages. So, for example, there's a British sign language that is different from the American sign language. So the American sign language is known as ASL. Then there's a British one. It's different. There are communication problems. There is a French sign language, and this is all over the world. There is Thai sign language. There is Russian sign language. And what's important is that it's not that those languages are different for the same reasons that the spoken languages in the countries are different. Sign language actually does not have the structure. American sign language does not have the structure of English at all. It's a very different language in that way. And the reason that all of the languages are different from country to country is because the symbols that you use with your hands are different from country to country. Cat will be one thing in American Sign Language, one thing in Thai Sign Language. Everybody does not, for example, I imagine you could mime a cat by making up your fist and sticking your fingers up or something. It's not like that. So, very different languages. Most of the signs don't mean what an outsider might suppose. Or another way of putting it is that what you would come up with to say something is probably not the way they say it. And so, for example, as a hearing person, you might think that the way to indicate sale is to make a gesture where you take your hand and make the little cartoon waves going in front. Like we hearing people could communicate sale or water by going like that. Well, that's not the sign for sale in sign language. They have something else. So, for example, the sign for home involves putting your five fingers together and putting them up to the side of your mouth. And that's a nice little gesture. You would never predict that that was what home was going to be. Now, as it happens, what that's supposed to symbolize is a kiss, which ideally is something that you get on at least a fairly regular basis at home. However, it's not predictable. It's one of billions of ways that you might symbolize home with your hand, which is to show that this is a vocabulary in a real language. We think of a cute yapping thing that's especially cute when its paws are big when it's young and that licks you as a dog, and we call it that. Now, as English speakers, we probably have this entrenched sense that there's something doggy about the word dog. Like, it's a dog, that sort of thing. That is purely arbitrary. There is nothing about d or g that corresponds with Fido. Has anybody named their dog Fido since like 1950 or Spot or Rover, but we're still doing that. So there's no such thing as that. In the same way, there's no reason why home is hand smooch. These are languages. ASL, last time I counted, had about 4,000 different signs. And the sign languages parallel spoken ones in terms of natural history. Many of today's sign languages, exactly how many of them is not known at this point, because we're only just beginning to learn about the sign languages of other countries, but many of them can be traced to one sign language which was created in France in 1775 at a school for the deaf. So this was a sort of a proto-world for sign language. And sign languages have dialects as well. They vary slightly among communities. Actually, sign languages are artificial in that they were created deliberately. It wasn't that deaf people very gradually started doing this, and next thing they knew, they had a language. This had to be created. But these languages are also creoles, in a way, in that they are not as accreted with mess as an old language would be. And also, because that same situation that we saw in Hawaii has happened with sign language as well, which is, and actually the sign language case is a better demonstration that we have an innate capacity and even imperative to speak in a real way or communicate in a real way, use language in a real way, that we'll come up with even if we're not given adequate input. So just like the kids in Hawaii heard their parents' pidgin English and somehow you pressed a button on the kids and they came out with a fluent Creole, in Nicaragua, the Sandinistas established a school for the deaf in the 1980s. And it used to be that in Nicaragua, deaf kids were basically just hidden at home. And you would work out a way to talk to your parents based on things like making the sign that I was making for water to indicate sail. And if you hang around with people long enough, you can do pretty well. But only pretty well. You cannot communicate as a human being throwing your hands around. You're permanently cut off from real interaction with people. So at this school, you had kids who were together, all bringing to the school the system of what they called mimicas, these kind of mimickings, these kind of homegrown ways of indicating things, like I suppose dog would be to do what we often do to indicate a dog in the shadows or something like that. So you stick up, I could never do those things. Anyway, you make the dog's ear with your thumb or something like that. Well, they were all doing that. So basically, there was this pidgin input. Now, what happens if you are a Nicaraguan deaf kid and you turn that person around and you press the button, you oprima the button on them? Well, it turns out they came out with a fluent Creole as well, but it was with their hands. So it started out that all the kids were running around speaking pidgin, except with their hands. But people must talk, and if you're deaf, you have to, quote-unquote, talk. And so after a while, and it was really good that there were linguists on site watching this happen, led by Judy Kegel, you had the kids developing gradually, but quickly, a language, an actual sign language where everybody was doing it the same way, where you could express any thought with any amount of nuance. And it was interesting. Older kids who were relatively older when they got there, often could only use the Creole sign language so well. They were past their point, as opposed to one little tyke who they actually have films of, who very quickly was just signing like lightning and expressing himself better than almost anybody there because he had been brought there when his mind was still plastic. So it's very, very interesting in that way. I had the occasion to go to where that school is and to see these kids. I was asked to be part of a special where my job was to be the specialist in Creoles and say, this is interesting in terms of Creolization, and I kept saying that. And for some reason, I always had to say it in some picturesque setting. So at one point, I was up in like the arms of a tree, as if I was, you know, there, just sitting there, and I had to say my little bit. At another point, they had me arriving by walking up on the beach with this sack on my back. I came on the plane with everybody else, but they had to make it into a story where apparently I just came out of the water. Anyway, I was watching these kids. And you know what's interesting about this in terms of these being real languages? You can know intellectually. As a linguist, I knew ASL is a language. But then you go and you see people speaking a sign language. This is not being ASL, but Nicaraguan Sign Language. And the first thing I noticed spending an afternoon at the school, and I know this is going to sound silly, but they weren't talking. They really don't talk. I'd never spent time with any people who didn't talk. You know, I'll see a couple of deaf people on the corner. There's a whole room of people who don't talk. Instead, you hear the rustling of clothes and stuff, and the rustling of clothes because they're talking with their hands. And that's really all they do. And it's a really wonderful way to see that they were talking. Because despite the fact that they weren't talking, and never did over the whole week, I kept waiting, then I realized this is really what they do. They only talk with their hands. They flirt. You know, talk about something very, very subtle. You know, flirting is subtle. You don't walk up to somebody and say, I am going to flirt with you. You don't walk up to somebody and say, so, how about it, sailor, or something like that. Flirting is a very subtle thing. They flirted, and not just in wiggling their eyebrows around and shaking their hips, but with their hands and putting their fingers on their chins and talking the way that we do. Another indication that it's an actual tongue and not a trick is that, imagine we English speakers. Often, I think we have a sense, and I may be projecting from myself, but I don't think so. Because of the world we live in, this enormous country where everybody speaks this language, then you put on the fedora, you skirt your wife, and you go to Germany, and everybody there still speaks English. And then you look at TV, English. Look at the movies, English. You listen to music, English. You feel like everybody speaks English. And so, in a way, you might go somewhere or deal with somebody who really doesn't speak English, and there's this vague sense people often have that if you yell, then they'll understand. I said, put on your fedora, and that's supposed to do it, because English is God's language. That's what these kids thought about Nicaraguan Sign Language. They knew intellectually that I was a hearing person, that I could not talk with them. But over the week, they kept seeming to think that somehow I was just going to get it. They'd make the sign more explicit, and I had to keep saying, I don't know it. You know, but of course I couldn't say it because they couldn't hear. In other words, it is a language. My nickname was a sign where they would put their finger on their eyebrow, because apparently my eyebrows are kind of obscenely large. So I was the brow. They had a nickname. This is a language with nicknames, etc. So, sign languages are very much languages. They are created artificially, but they are new languages, and in a sense, newer languages than Creoles. They are simpler in structure than older languages, but then on the other hand, they do have their complexities and quite different ones than the ones that the hearing people in the culture speak. So, for example, we saw the numeral classifiers in Chinese where you have to say one flat of table and you have to say one long of pencil, etc. Sign languages have that. It's based on the shape of things, and when you use your numbers, you indicate what the shape of this object was. You don't necessarily have to do that, but that's just something that has become a habit in ASL and a lot of other sign languages. And there are various systems for writing ASL, but it remains primarily a spoken language. It's hard to actually indicate on the page how to sign. And they're working on it, but that is a certain obstacle that one at this point, there is no such thing as a written literature in sign because there's no way to write it gracefully yet. But there are dialect continua with sign language. Some sign language is closer to English than others. There's good old-fashioned ASL, which is really very much its own thing. Then there are ways of signing that are based partly on how spoken English works, the idea being to build a bridge between the two. And on top of that, there are extremely prickly political issues connected with all of these things. I would say that as a linguist, in terms of the politics being thick, I'm not sure which conferences are more ticklish, the ones about Black English or the ones about sign language. It's a very rich, delicate subject. So that is to say that these are artificial languages, but they are very much languages, just like the 6,000 others in the world.